Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 398, recorded on Sunday, October 3rd, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
Arsenal for Democracy this week continues our mini-series on money in the 19th century United States. What was it? Was it something physical with a real value or more of an abstraction? How did people understand it at the time versus how we understand money today? What were the economic, political, and socio-cultural implications of the 19th century version of American money? In part one of this series, we talked about the chaotic private sector-dominated monetary policy of the pre-Civil War United States. In part two, we explored the emergency shift to a national paper currency during the Civil War, and then the partial winding down of those policies during the Reconstruction period that followed. In part three, we talked about how ordinary Americans conducted their day-to-day and year-to-year transactions with consistently sparse amounts of money in circulation, often relying on credit. Today in Part 4, we return to the politics of this problem with greenbackers, the free silver movement, and the cross of gold. In the mid-1870s, Reconstruction was winding down, but the debate over monetary policy was only heating up more with every passing year. By 1877, Reconstruction was officially declared over, and the economy was well into a deflationary cycle where U.S. dollars were getting stronger as demand for them and confidence in them continued to outpace the actual money in circulation. Employers, both through greed and their own struggles to access sufficient cash, were attempting to slash wages that people needed to buy things from the growing consumer market of the Second Industrial Revolution. And we did an episode on the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 if you want to get into that more. In the 1870s, many Americans and their politicians often still struggled to understand money on a fundamental level and how it worked. No small surprise, since a national currency and monetary policy had only really just emerged in the early 1860s with the Civil War. The long cultural hangover of the antebellum monetary chaos and unreliable private money convinced many that the biggest danger was, quote, unsound money. They wanted money backed by expensive precious metals, and not a lot of it. Others, by contrast, believed that the real danger was the chronic and omnipresent shortages of American money in circulation in the U.S. economy, for all the reasons we've outlined in the previous episodes of this series. Both sides were being lobbied by various disunited factions of business interests, depending on their particular alignments to industry, mining, banks, retailers, and so on. Because, of course, if you think about it, the banks want certain things out of the economy and inflation or deflation, and their debtors want other things, and then those businesses have various customers. And so everyone has slightly different interests in this, even if they're under the broad umbrella of business interests. The public often fanatically took sides as well in this debate. And out of this divide emerged many of the political battles of the 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s in the United States. So Rachel has done most of the research and write-up for this week's episode, but I have a lot of observations to make and discuss with her as we go through it. But Rachel, we're going to be returning to some of the books that we had talked about in parts one and two this week. And if you could tell us a little bit about the battle over silver money that was emerging in this period, I think that would be a really important foundation for the rest of this episode.
Yeah. So, as you mentioned, we're pulling from some of the books we read. In particular, in this episode, we're primarily focusing on Inflated, How Money and Debt Built the American Dream by R. Christopher Whalen, published in 2011, and with a little bit from Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1877 by Eric Foner, which was published in 1988, And we're going to mention a little bit from The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World by Patrick Wyman, published in July of this year. And as always, all of our sources will be linked in the show notes on arsenalfordemocracy.com. Beginning with this battle over silver money, there was a discovery of large deposits of silver in the West, particularly in Colorado, Idaho, and Nevada. And a lot of mining happening at this time, and so the pressure was on the Treasury to resume large purchases of silver at the previous ratio of 16 to 1 that we've mentioned in previous episodes versus gold, even though the market price for silver was half of that. The mines were producing so much silver that the oversupply was depressing prices, often below the point of profitable extraction. And so enter Senator John Sherman, Republican from Ohio, and his inflation bill. Even though he was a strong supporter of a return to the gold standard, he introduced his bill in January 1874, and his proposal was to require government purchases of silver, which would have an effect of increasing the issuance of greenbacks, which would be used to make the purchases of silver. This would increase the money supply. Sherman's proposal was attempting to toe the line between inflation proponents and those who demanded the return of the gold standard. After a four-month debate, it passed the Republican-controlled Congress, but was vetoed by President Grant. Grant's veto officially demonstrated the Republican Party's alignment with business interests and the gold standard over the working class, who were in favor of an increased money supply. This veto was very costly for Grant and the Republicans as a party. In November of 1874, Democrats won a majority in the House and several seats in the Senate, although Republicans were able to hold a majority there. And from this time forward, the Republicans would generally be known as the party of so-called sound money, or money backed by these precious metals, and on the side of business interests. And the Democrats were seen as the advocates of inflation and the working man. This idea of sound money at the time was far more of a cultural concept than anything grounded meaningfully in economics from a modern perspective.
I wanted to note something here, Rachel, which is that one of the things that I want to emphasize from especially the most recent episode that we did, part three, is that the issue here is often framed, again, in these cultural terms, like you just said, at the time anyway, and even sort of retrospectively it often is. And I think that's one thing where I definitely don't like the Whalen book, which we are drawing from here for at least the broad strokes of the debate, because he's actually quite against inflation and sort of favors this sound money concept even in the 21st century, which is a little bit odd to me. I mean, that's just his ideological perspective, I guess. But at the time, and again, even some of the sort of people like him talking about it now, it's framed around this idea of like, well, of course, all these people just sort of, you know, borrowed all this money and they couldn't pay it back. So they wanted inflation so they could get out of their debts and so forth. What I think we've tried to show over the previous episodes of this miniseries is that there literally was a significant shortage of money in circulation, right? This idea of we need easy money and so forth. Yes, that obviously appeals to certain, you know, business guys starting up businesses or extending credit to, you know, float operations in the West or wherever, right? Like, there's definitely a business constituency for easy money as well. But this idea of like, well, all these, you know, irresponsible plebs and farmers just wanted to have easy money and, you know, all on their terms, blah, 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 right? That's the like cultural framing around this, which I think existed at the time if you were for the sound money and for the gold standard. And it's definitely something that still sort of floats around today and kind of looking back on this, which is kind of what we're going to take a look at with things like the Cross of Gold speech and so forth. But, the issue here, again, is there just was this shortages of circulation, and what we've tried to demonstrate in the recent episodes, and I think this actually, if you look at one of the other books that we talked about earlier in the series and on previous episodes before this series, The Rise and Fall of American Growth by Robert J. Gordon, published in 2016, he just kind of goes through and looks at what are all the things that consumers could buy? What, you know, there was this huge boom in production of consumer goods and materials and foods and all kinds of basics that suddenly became available. But that's only available if you have money with which to buy them. And as we talked about on the most recent episode, there were all these ways that people tried to sort of get around that problem by, you know, payment plans over time and various consumer financing or proto-consumer financing. And we're going to be talking a lot more about that in the next episode. But I think it's important to remember that we have a combination of not enough money in circulation and that problem getting worse as the demand increases for buying things. And that's important to bear in mind through all of this discussion when we're talking about why the working men and the farmers and so forth would have wanted more money in circulation, which they viewed as, we can accomplish this through silver. And we're going to talk later in this episode about why that also doesn't completely make sense, but that was their perspective on this. So I'll turn it back to you, Rachel.
Yeah, to really underline this cultural concept of sound money versus inflation, I'm going to read a quote from Foner's Reconstruction. Reformers in the Republican Party advocated a return to specie payments and deprecated calls for inflation of the nation's paper currency and the redemption of government bonds and greenbacks. Like free trade, the quote-unquote honest dollar of gold embodied natural law, while inflation, wrote North American Review editor Charles Elliott Norton, means dishonesty, corruption, repudiation. Limited government formed another pillar of reform faith, for state intervention in economic affairs fostered all the distasteful aspects of Gilded Age politics, bribery, high taxes, and public extravagance. So kind of bringing in that laissez-faire economic policy that you might have learned about in a history class in high school. So back to Whalen. The Bland-Allison Act of 1878, shortly after the end of Reconstruction, tried to bridge the gap between Eastern business interests, who favored sound money, and the inflationists of the West. This act authorized the Treasury to purchase a certain amount of silver annually and to mint silver dollar coins, which were made legal tender. These purchases, as in the unsuccessful inflation bill, were to be made with paper money and increase the money supply. President Hayes vetoed the act, but both houses of Congress were able to override the veto. This helped to somewhat repair the Republicans' image and staved off the rise of the Greenback Party, but it also wasn't effective in stabilizing the price of silver or helping it to reach that old ratio of 16 to 1. Under the law, about 25 million silver coins were minted, but few circulated. Instead, the Treasury issued silver certificates that operated similarly to greenbacks, as they were legal tender and could be redeemed at the Treasury for silver coinage.
So I thought this part was interesting because it reminded me of the Wyman book and talking about that sort of crunch period of insufficient hard metal coinage currency in Europe. And then, you know, this was in the 1400s. And then, you know, they had this boom in silver production and gold production. And some of that was a boom in Europe itself. And some of that was new, I guess we'll say trade, but, you know, colonial activities by Portugal in West Africa and then by Spain with regard to both silver and gold in South America and Mexico. This is interesting to me, though. Again, I want to read this sentence that Rachel just said. So under the law, and this is, we're talking here about the Bland-Allison Act of 1878, 25 million silver coins were minted in the United States, but few circulated. Instead, the Treasury issued silver certificates, which operated similarly to greenbacks as they were legal tender, but they could be redeemed for silver coinage, right? So the greenbacks, there was the fiat period in the Civil War where they weren't necessarily redeemable. And then one thing we haven't exactly talked about here, but there was this sort of paper money phase where, you know, they kind of compromise and say, well, we're going to circulate paper, but you can redeem it for gold as needed. And then you have these silver certificates, which are the equivalent except for only redeemed in silver coinage. And this reminds me of the Wyman book because of this idea. This was sort of the workaround in the 1400s when you had these shortages of silver in circulation, right? And it's very inconvenient, which is also true in the United States in this period. I mean, think about, you know, trying to fend off train robberies and things like that. You don't want to be moving around large quantities of silver coins everywhere. That's very inconvenient. But you could have people just say, well, we'll let you keep the silver coins in a vault somewhere and we'll just transfer paper certificates back and forth that can be ultimately redeemed for those, you know, silver coins in theory. But why do you need to redeem it, right? Just keep circulating. as we'll see, this didn't necessarily work out, but it kind of goes to this point that I think we want to keep making here, which is like there were certain moments where you can see they're almost kind of getting it and saying like, here's how we could kind of transition to a sort of more abstracted circulatory economy. And then they didn't actually execute on that completely, right? They just kind of got stuck, I feel like. Do you get that impression too, that like they were kind of almost to the point of like, oh, here's how we can like get more money in circulation, but then they just got like really hung up on, you know, well, it needs to be backed, it needs to have, you know, the money needs to be in the vault somewhere, and you need to have it at these, you know, these ratios, which, as we'll talk about, weren't necessarily like fiscally sustainable or economically sensical.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe in the sources we've read, it doesn't really explain how the fiat currency was really seen by the average citizen. So I don't know why there was this rush to go back to sound money or backed money, because it seems like the fiat currency worked.
Well, I think the sources that we talked about with like part one and two was that it wasn't well regarded, right? There, like during the purely fiat period, there were problems where, you know, the reputation was quite bad. People are still thinking about the unsound paper money issued by banks in the antebellum period. You know, you have these problems of redemption where like people are, you know, in certain cases, it's the fiat money is meant to be legal tender, but that only, you know, if the vendor decides they're not going to accept it, even though they're required by law to, what are you going to do about it? Right. And then also that the US government by necessity was still doing certain customs payments in gold rather than the paper money. And they had to pay foreign debts in actual metal rather than in paper money. And that's, as we'll circle back to later in this episode, obviously a significant difference between that time period and today, because we don't have to do that today because the US is in a different position today. But this would have been, you know, a challenge. And so you know, as we talked about, there was that period where during the Civil War, you have, especially if the Civil War effort is going badly, right? Who wants to take a chance on this paper money? Because who knows what the, you know, actual return on that is going to be later. You know, are you going to be able to cash it in at face value later? Who knows, right? And then it sort of stabilizes, and in the Reconstruction period, kind of, you know, evens out, and you get sort of closer to a one-to-one ratio in terms of, you know, what is the value of a gold dollar versus what is the value of a paper dollar. But I'm sympathetic to, I can see why there would be skepticism around this and a reluctance. But again, you're at a point where you've got 25 million silver coins sitting in a vault and you're not willing to use them in circulation because there's obvious downsides to using them in circulation. And you try to circulate these silver certificates. But then, of course, you know, I think what happens is that by imposing an artificial ratio that doesn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense, you then see the problems of that. So the thing that would have made sense here would be to jump to circulating around paper money. And they couldn't make that leap. And I think a lot of that is, again, part of that is to do with actual economic reasons, usually related to foreign exchange. But part of it is a psychological and philosophical thing of people being like, well, I don't trust that, therefore, because that's one of the points actually in the Graeber book, which is another one that I read this summer before we did this series. So this was the late David Graeber, the anarchist economic anthropologist, his book Debt, the First 5,000 Years in 2011. A lot of his stuff is about the idea of sort of trust, which, you know, inherently in a country as spread out as the United States and sparsely populated as much of the United States was in this time period, and the individualist culture of the United States, a lot of monetary stuff and means of exchange depends on a high level of trust. And that is kind of one of the big differences between, say, this and like 1400s Western European trade and finance exchange networks that Wyman talks about, because in those cases, you have that level of trust. You know that if you go to the thing, you know, the bank in Antwerp or Barcelona, you're going to be able to find somebody that is either a literal relative of yours or works for this one of the institutions that you know back home, right? There's a local branch, and you can go in there and do your paperwork and everything and make your little trades on paper without having to make actual physical metal currency trades. That only works if you have that sort of reliable network. And of course, as we know in the United States, especially before the 20th century, not a high level of sort of government oversight or some institution like the Catholic Church that's like an, you know, international institution that's found everywhere. We talked about that with the Spanish Empire as a point of contrast on an earlier episode in this series. There isn't that glue binding together Americans to say, and you know, they were able to do it in the 1400s in Europe even without having systems like the telegraph, but it really, you know, you had to get to a point in the United States where, and Kelly talked about this last time with regard to things like credit ratings agencies emerging in this period, it takes a long time in the United States to start having the level of like people spread out in branches around the country across state lines, you know, along rail lines, at the telegraph offices, things like that, who are able to talk back and forth to each other and have that level of trust that they can make these exchanges on paper, right? That they can even just exchange sort of bank transfers without sort of prohibitive risk hedging fees attached and things like that, right? And I think we're seeing a similar thing here, which is just that this is a naturally suspicious country filled with hyper-individualist people, for the most part, right? Obviously, there's exceptions to that, especially in some of the immigrant populations that were moving in this period, and that the country is filled with con men, right? Like, and that's certainly true in this time period. I mean, you know, this is, you know, between medicine men and flim-flammy reconstruction guys going down there and getting up to financial shenanigans in the deep South, you can understand, I guess, why people would be kind of suspicious of this. So this is sort of one of the themes of this episode is like, none of the policies being articulated here make sense. None of the policies actually fix the problems, but you can also kind of see how people got there, even if they were bad solutions. So that's kind of the observation that I wanted to make here is like, they're so close to getting to that breakthrough of being able to conduct business without needing to like physically move around some of this metal stuff and be so fixated on, you know, metals exchange rates and government-backed purchases of production quotas and things like that. And then they just don't make that actual breakthrough. And the you know, they're doing it in these artificial ratios that, of course, then fuels this idea of this is totally unsound. It's not back. And so it's almost the worst of both worlds, where it's simultaneously the downsides of metal-backed money with all the downsides of the so-called unsound money. And I think it just adds up in general to a lot of suspicion. What I know you're about to talk about here is the gradual pressure in which gold is supposed to be acting alongside silver and ends up kind of disappearing from circulation and worsening the problem even further because the silver ratios were just so out of whack that, of course, people were going to, you know, say, well, as an investment vehicle, I need to move around my money and convert it and back and forth and these sort of things. And that was something that I found really interesting. So I guess you can go into kind of that, but we have to kind of get there with this sort of political evolution, again, from this 1878 legislation toward the, you know, across the 1880s and into the 1890s.
Right. So moving forward into the 1890s, Republicans had really abandoned the political rights of freed slaves and all the tenets of Reconstruction pretty much entirely. And in 1891, Senator William Stewart of Nevada used a procedural motion to substitute free coinage of silver for voting rights legislation. So free coinage of silver was more popular politically than protecting voting rights in the South. There was a depression in the winter of 1891, and unemployment was spreading nationwide. So there was hope among Republicans that pro-silver legislation would help them in the polls more than the loss of black votes in the South would harm them. So really just the complete abandonment of the black voting bloc completely until the 1960s, basically. So the Sherman Silver Purchase Act called for the Treasury to purchase 4 million ounces of silver per month, which was essentially the entire amount produced in the U.S. And this happened in 1890. Another source indicated that Mexico also experienced a surge in American investment in silver mining to supply the U.S. government demand. So the Treasury paid for these purchases in paper dollars. Many Americans sold their silver for paper money, then bought gold coins. The preference for gold or paper money over silver caused silver prices to fall. Also, world production of silver rose from 63 million ounces per year in 1873 to over 150 million ounces in 1892, further causing prices to fall. This meant that most countries, also engaged in serious monetary debates at the time, were deciding it was simply no longer cost-effective or sensible to mint silver coins. The depletion of gold from the Treasury caused by widespread purchase of gold led to the repeal of the Sherman Silver Purchase Act within 3 years of its passage. So, all this meddling with the money supply by the federal government left public confidence in banks, financial markets, U.S. currency, and the economy at a new low. The volatility of the U.S. economy in the 1890s alarmed the rest of the world. Foreign banks and individuals sought to exchange their paper dollars for gold, and U.S. exports of gold increased dramatically. This caused the U.S. to default on convertibility, or the ability to convert your paper money into the hard metal money, and the Treasury forced U.S. banks to take paper rather than gold. The final nail in the Republicans' coffin was 1892 legislation that removed all remaining limits on the coinage of silver at the 16-to-1 exchange ratio with gold that was now widely diverged from the actual market exchange value. So the Republicans lost badly in 1892, and when Democrat Grover Cleveland and the Democrats swept Congress and the White House in 1892, the economy was collapsing as both foreign creditors and U.S. citizens were demanding payment in gold and fleeing paper assets. By 1893, the drop in silver prices caused a series of bank failures and the bursting of the investment bubble in railroads. After this, many companies were driven into bankruptcy, many of them in the West. So this was the Panic of 1893. The Sherman Silver Purchase Act had to be repealed to prevent all the U.S. gold reserves from being used up as people exchanged silver for gold at an official but artificial exchange rate and then sold the gold on the open market for much more money.
Okay, so I want to, before we move on from this and talk about the aftermath of this, I want to just recap the dynamics of what we've just heard Rachel talk about here. So, because this is a little bit complicated to follow, especially because this is one of the problems with using precious metal that is also a commodity as your money thing, right? One of the challenges here is like you ideally, and Graeber goes a lot into this idea of like what do you use as the material for your exchange. Often it's ideal for you to use something that doesn't get used for anything else, because then you can assign value to it and use it as a medium of exchange, right? That's the terminology here. And of course, in this case, silver bullion and gold bullion both, you know, primarily used for money, but also used for lots of other things, right? Jewelry, silverware, literally, things like that, right? So what we're seeing happen here is that the U.S. government is requiring itself, by law, the Treasury, to purchase huge amounts of silver bullion per month to mint into silver coins. They are doing this at a ratio with gold, right? So they are buying the silver in paper. The paper money has a, at least theoretically, and at this point, I think in practice, relatively close to a one-to-one exchange with a gold dollar, right? But the government is buying the bullion from the silver mines at a fixed ratio well above the actual price of the silver. So again, to visualize this, and there was actually, we found an image from one of these political debates where they had minted these sort of fake coins out of silver, where they said, this is the size of a disc of how much silver you can buy on the open market for one US dollar. And this smaller area within this disc is the amount that we are buying as government policy with $1, right? So on the open market, you could buy a lot more silver for the same dollar than they were buying, which means the government is overpaying for silver consistently. Obviously, you can see why the senator from Nevada was really psyched about doing this, because this benefits the silver mines in Nevada, right? They're getting a huge amount of money here. And then they, you know, they turn around, right? And they those companies are obviously dispersing that paper money out into the economy through their various economic activities, et cetera. But the U.S. government, meanwhile, is circulating this silver out. But the silver coins that they're issuing into circulation, or doing so with the silver certificates that we talked about, in lieu of that, the paper certificates, right? Those don't have the actual value on the market that the government is saying that it does. So on the open market, they want to make a trade from, you know, a silver certificate or a silver dollar or whatever into a paper dollar, right? Because there's a legally guaranteed exchange rate there. And then you take that paper dollar and you turn it into gold by buying gold, selling gold, et cetera, right? You convert it back and forth, however is appropriate to your situation. You are getting a lot more bang for your buck by doing that because the silver is not trading at its face value. So the effect of this is people want to get rid of their silver or their silver certificates, and they want to instead have gold. Meanwhile, the paper money, you know, there's this panic that happens. All the foreign creditors, everyone else is like, we don't really want paper anymore. We need gold. But meanwhile, everyone else has been gaming the system, playing arbitrage here, right? Gaming these exchange rates this whole time. So they're hoarding gold, right? Because they've been converting into gold this whole time. So gold, and the problem is when you do that, people aren't spending the gold. They're putting it, you know, in their basement or whatever, right? Or they're putting it in a vault somewhere, or they're hiding it under their mattress or whatever they're doing. They're hiding the gold. They're hoarding the gold. Now, all of a sudden, the government doesn't physically have the gold reserves on hand to be able to pay off these foreign creditors that are calling this in when the panic happens, or in the, you know, the years leading up to this, right? The market exchange rate value has gone out the window relative to the official value. There's not enough gold going around to make basic payments. They have to default on this principle of convertibility, right? And there isn't enough gold. That's the bottom line here. You're tying yourself, you're shackling yourself, or as William Jennings Bryan is about to call it, you're crucifying yourself on the cross of gold, but there also physically is not enough gold going around. Now, as we're about to talk about, bizarrely, his suggestion is that we need to double down on the silver policy that's causing this, right? As opposed to figuring out something else to do. But this is the problem that they're finding themselves in. And the silver policy is clearly causing this, right? But it's also clear that it just economically wasn't going to make sense to do it at the actual market rate. And that's why all the other countries were switching off of using a bimetallic standard, right? The other countries are even stopping issuing silver coinage, right? Because they're just like, this is stupid. You can't, at an actual market rate, that's not going to destroy your monetary supply and circulation patterns. You can't do this because the silver, there's so much of it being produced that it's so incredibly cheap that the math doesn't work here, right? And every other country in the world is figuring this out and going, yeah, time to tap out and just focus on gold or do something else. And the United States is just continuing to attempt to double down on this further and further. Now, ultimately, the gold side wins, which, as we'll talk about, is also not great. But there is this big last push to try to go for silver here as the solution to all of these problems. So, Rachel, I don't know if you had any comments on what I just said before you get into that. But I just wanted to kind of like, I hope I'm not making this more confusing, but I want people to understand what the like economic sort of vortex that's happening here in the panic of 1893 and then the run up to William Jennings Bryan in 1896.
Yeah, I just really wanted to highlight the bullheadedness of the U.S. in contrast to Europe at this time. So they were deciding it was no longer cost effective or sensible to mint silver coins. And we just really were gung ho on minting the silver coins in spite of the overwhelming evidence that it was bad. So it was just like, full speed ahead, no matter how wrong the direction was that we were traveling in. So yeah, it's just kind of gotta underline that point because it is a huge part of our history as a country, it seems like. So going back to the 1890s, on the heels of this economic unrest and depression, and with the pro-gold wing of the Democrats seemingly irreparably tarnished by the economic collapse, there emerged a figure who rocketed to political stardom on a platform of free silver, William Jennings Bryan. Bryan, in his tenure as a Democratic congressman from Nebraska, had passionately spoken against the repeal of the Sherman Silver Purchase Act in 1893. After this, he worked diligently from 1894 to 1896 to raise the profile of the Silverite Democrats, delivering speeches and organizing meetings for the National Silver Committee, which he founded. At the 1896 Democratic National Convention, Bryan was able to raise enough free silver Democrats to overcome the gold standard Democrats led by President Grover Cleveland. However, he faced fairly significant obstacles during the convention. He initially didn't even have official delegate status. Nebraska sent both a silverite and a gold standard slate to the convention, and the DNC seated the pro-gold slate of delegates first. It took the convention's credentials committee to overrule the DNC's decision and seat the silverite slate of delegates for Nebraska. After this kerfuffle was resolved, Bryan, in a stirring Cross of Gold speech, tied the cause of bimetallism to the plight of the working class. In the famous conclusion of the speech, Bryan declared, "Having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests, the laboring interests, and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold," which caused the pro-silver delegates to basically go wild. And Bryan won the support of the silver crowd, and he ultimately won the Democratic nomination on the fifth ballot without any votes from the gold Democrats. This left the party deeply fragmented. This fragmentation gave the victory to pro-gold standard Republican William McKinley, who swept the more populated Northeast and Midwest, where the business interests were, while Bryan won the West and the South. And while Bryan tried to run 4 years later on the same silver message, he failed to maintain his message's resonance with the populist wing of the Democratic Party, and he never really got to keep his popularity after that peak in 1896.
So I wanted to talk now about this because that's what we've titled the episode, right? The Cross of Gold. That's sort of the culmination of this battle over silver versus gold. And it's this very dramatic moment. And then he just gets completely owned, right? Just totally destroyed. And that's the end of the silver push, basically. The gold standard wins, right? The Democrats eventually come back around to the gold standard. The Republicans ran on gold standard and won, etc. So what are the merits or lack thereof of the two dominant positions on coinage and money in the 1896 election? We have, on the one hand, bimetallism, free silver, right? That's the William Jennings Bryan side with the Democrats versus gold standard on the Republican sides. In my view, bimetallism was stupid and non-viable. It was also not the actual solution needed for the real problems at hand. However, the deflationary gold standard, also deeply stupid and counterproductive too. I think that points to a theme of this series we've been doing, which is that people in the late 19th century United States were fixated on money and monetary policy, right? It was a huge popular topic of debate, but they still couldn't really intellectually or philosophically understand what it was, how it worked, and what the monetary policy choice implications would be. The one thing that I think we can say that was probably not their fault is that the United States was still very much in a transitional phase in a lot of ways, right? For one thing, they're transitioning into the ranks of the major powers. They're just starting to get sort of major power status. And they were still very dependent on other powers and foreign creditors who were working in precious metals or other reserve currencies most of the time. And by that, I mean, like, you know, as opposed to saying all transactions are being done in dollars, all transactions are being converted into something like the British pound sterling or, you know, some other currency. And that's obviously a huge contrast from the present day situation where the United States dollar is that reserve currency and all the transactions are happening in dollars and you get a lot more flexibility that way. The other thing, of course, is that point raised in the Gordon book, which is that this is a massive period of transformation in the United States economy into a consumer economy for the first time, right? That it's not just small little pockets of industry and finance and mercantile activity with this huge agrarian base. Now you have this actual genuinely like significant industrial working class base, emerging middle class, a consumer activity sphere that's growing by leaps and bounds. You know, every day you can buy all these different things. And it's probably hard for people in the moment while that's happening to understand the change that is happening, right? Similarly to how it's hard to understand this change that is happening with the United States transitioning into its status as a world power, which really would not be sort of completed. That arc is not completed until the, you know, start of World War One, and or at least the end of World War One for sure. You know, you start to see kind of hints of it in the Roosevelt administration, the Teddy Roosevelt administration in the early 1900s, but that's still really kind of like testing out this new status. And I think, you know, the bimetallism problem is essentially that there's obviously a need for more inflation in the U.S. economy at that time. It would have been helpful to a lot of people. And I think ultimately it would have actually been helpful for most of the banks as well. They just, again, I don't think they fundamentally understood sort of this transition to a consumer economy that was happening or how much more economic activity would be created by allowing the economy to sort of take off in that way. And a lot of the reason that it took off at all is because of that easy money policy of the Civil War and its immediate aftermath. And they just didn't really understand that until hindsight. The other thing here is it probably only works if, because they did need more money in circulation, right? That's, I think, something that should be clear from the previous episodes on this series. Ordinary people, farmers, anybody that was in debt, anybody that needed to make transactions and payments, they needed to have more money in circulation than actually was available. And again, there were lots of attempted workarounds, but a lot of times you would just delay payments for really extended periods of time. And we talked about actually one of the factors with the collapse in 1893 was a lot of farmers just saying, well, I've had too many bad harvest cycles in a row. I can't pay off all this equipment that I've purchased on payment plans or, deferred payment. And I'm out. I'm functionally bankrupt. I'm leaving the sector. And we had actual starvation that was happening. You know, this is the era of bread lines, as we talked about before. This is when that starts in the United States, and that's a new phenomenon. And, you know, things kind of even out and rebalance and recalibrate over the course of, you know, the mid-1890s. But there was a very sort of tense period there where it was unclear what was going to happen. And again, a lot of this is there's not enough money in circulation to be able to get out from under these things. And it's viewed, when you frame it in terms of debt, then it makes it sound like a moral judgment on them, as I alluded to earlier, right? Oh, these are irresponsible farmers who borrowed too much, or these are irresponsible consumers who spent beyond their means. What I think I've hope we've tried to demonstrate in the last episode is that, in fact, debt, quote unquote, in many of these cases, was this new thing of these payment plans. And the reason for the payment plans was simply because you needed to have these things, right? Whether it was consumer essentials or farm equipment, you needed to have them or else you weren't going to be able to survive. And in order to get them, because you didn't have cash available, because there was so little in circulation and your payments were intermittent, whether it was waiting for a harvest to come in or waiting for an unreliable factory paycheck to come in, the process for evening out those cycles was to create all these payment plans, which looks on paper like debt. And then you say, well, look at all these debtors and they just want to get out of their debts. And that's not really what's happening. What's happening is that you have a shortage of money. And so it's clear that you needed to have more money in circulation, and you especially needed to have lower denominations of money in circulation. Now, one way you can solve this is by issuing a lot more paper money that can do things like fractional amounts, right? or you can issue smaller coins that probably need to be made out of some particular metal that is less expensive than certainly gold. But silver, it seems, was not the right one either. And you would have had to have those metals be exchangeable at clear market rates with the other stuff, right? If you have artificially pegged rates, that's not going to work very well. Not to say that artificial pegging on the currencies doesn't work in every case, but it doesn't work very well when you're talking about metal-to-metal conversions and conversions in and out of paper instruments that are backed by these metals. So bimetallism was an attempt to fix this problem of the need to have more money in circulation, easier money, right, softer money, and also that you needed to have more, you know, denominational flexibility and so forth. But it was executed very poorly in practice because of this official exchange rate, and it was not viable to do it at a different rate. I don't know what they needed to do. Maybe they needed to use some other metal. I'm not sure. Or they needed to somehow convince everyone to go to some sort of a paper standard, and people were just not prepared to make that leap psychologically, especially after the reputational problems during the Civil War, and certainly, as we talked about before, the free money, free banking era of every bank chartered by any state anywhere issuing their own sort of paper instruments of money. Obviously, the gold standard, also a completely idiotic thing to have in this period, because it's a deflationary period at the exact same time when you need people to be able to go out and buy stuff. Now, as we've said before, some of the deflation that's happening here is the same type of deflation that we see in, say, the post-internet period or the outsourcing period, the offshoring period of around the same time as the internet, where you start moving production overseas to the United States. So suddenly things like TVs and refrigerators are suddenly becoming fractionally expensive for consumers in the United States relative to what they had been. And you see a similar process that's happening during this period as well. And that's going to put some natural deflationary pressures on things, right? If clothing all of a sudden goes from a thing you can only afford two sets of for your whole week, and that's what you have to wear year round, to all of a sudden now everyone can buy clothing, right? Or your food costs dramatically shift, and now all of a sudden you can buy cheap canned food. That's going to create some deflationary pressures relatively naturally here, right? And the prices are going to collapse because that's the economic pressure that we see all of the people from like Marx to De Leon talking about in this second half of the 19th century. The tendency of the rate of profits to fall is partly because of all of the economic, ruthless economic competition between all these different industrialists driving down the prices as people get into producing the same type of goods and then undercutting each other with price cuts, right? That's obviously, we can see what's happening there. But there are other factors here, and one of the other factors is that there's this pressure to be on the gold standard and so forth, which is not flexible enough and is not enough money in circulation, right? If you're pulling money out of circulation, which of course doing all this, you know, gold hoarding is going to pull money out of circulation. If you're pulling more money out of circulation, you're going to have deflationary pressures as well. So it's not just a function of the prices of consumer goods and things like that. It's also this commodities issue, and it's also the monetary policy issue. So again, not sure how if I'm being clear here or if I'm being confusing, but I just want people to kind of think about the different effects that these policies had. And clearly, while the textbooks, I think, in this country tend to frame it as like, wow, kooky William Jennings Bryan with his dramatic speech that went nowhere ultimately and didn't really accomplish anything because the bimetallism policy was totally unworkable, as we've shown. That doesn't mean that the other side was any workable either. But one of the things that is sort of an interesting political cultural hangover even to present day is that you got people like Whalen still writing books in the 21st century arguing that essentially it was good and correct to pursue the gold standard during this period, and that the free silver people were all crazy whack job populists, and we need to watch out for the populist menace in this country because they don't know what they're doing, etc., etc., etc. And clearly, with hindsight and a sort of more objective look, I think it's more objective to look at it this way, you can see that the situation is different then than it is now. That's one thing that's important to note. And secondly, that people didn't really understand money at this time, that there was a transformation happening that was hard for them to understand as it's happening around them, and that there was a big sort of philosophical and cultural effect, which we're definitely going to talk about on the next episode when we get back into this idea of consumer debt versus investment debt, and how people kind of thought about that and the shifts that happen around kind of those ideas of consumption and spending within your means versus not, right? And this is the fundamental problem that we're sort of grappling with here. And I think it looks a lot different from the vantage point of today than it did at the time. So Rachel, I wanted to get your thoughts on this and this, the sort of silver politics here. I mean, obviously a lot of it's just kind of openly corrupt, you know, benefits to the silver miners, but I mean, there's more to it than that for sure.
Yeah, like you said, I think it is utterly ridiculous that we stuck to the 16-to-1 ratio just in spite of all the evidence that it wasn't working and it was actively harming the economy. So yeah, it was really stupid and non-viable, but gold wasn't any better. So it's interesting to see it from today's perspective because it's so obvious, like, oh yeah, paper money, fiat money is good and would probably fix a lot of the problems that both factions created. But there, like you said, there wasn't that trust there that exists today because we are existing in a society where the United States dollar is the reserve currency, is the currency that's used around the world, is the most powerful currency. So it's really interesting to look back to a time when the US dollar just didn't have that trust in it. It just wasn't so powerful. And so I think it's really interesting to see how much we've changed, just in the last century in regards to our monetary policy and switching off of that gold standard and to that fiat currency. I've said before over the course of the series that I've had to think a lot more about money than ever before, or more than I wanted to. But it's interesting, even me, a self-professed novice when it comes to these money matters, still have a lot more instinctual knowledge as to the movement of money and what money means, more so than people back then did. Like, I think we have a concept of money that is just like running in the background of our mind, so we don't even have to think about it. And that didn't exist back then. So there was a lot more distrust of money, a lot more questioning of how to use money and what the instruments should look like. So it's really interesting to contrast these two periods of time.
One of the interesting things that Graeber argues in his book, and I think, again, you know, some people might dispute this, but, you know, it was interesting to me to think about as I was reading his book on debt the first 5,000 years, is this idea that coinage itself is clearly related to lack of trust. And he talks about that in particular around, say, the Eastern Mediterranean, you know, ancient Greece and the Persian empires and the Egyptians and that, all those sort of groups, that you start to see coinage emerge in that context as opposed to previous systems of money and monetary policy. You know, and he talks about earlier existing systems of like, well, all of the bullion is held at the temple and a guy goes around and moves a card around, or, you know, the equivalent of a card, right? It probably would have been a clay tablet with cuneiform, and says, okay, we've transferred this amount to so-and-so. This is now their pile, right? But you don't actually have to go into the temple to do that. What he argued in his book is that when you start having these large mercenary armies going around, especially Greek mercenaries, going around the Eastern Mediterranean, offering their services, going on these various military campaigns, now you have a problem of trust, because you're not going to extend credit to the mercenary soldier when he comes through your town, if he's on his best behavior, right? Worst case scenario, he's doing some pillaging and other things that aren't great, and that's obviously not a great basis for trust. But at minimum, if he's on his best behavior, you're not going to, you know, if he comes into your equivalent of the ancient grocery store, which I realize is not a real thing, but, you know, I'm being facetious here, right? You're not going to extend him a line of credit at the general store like you would in this period, right? You're not going to say, oh, this guy's a good credit risk. I know he's good for it. He'll come back and pay me later in some form, because he's not going to, right? He's going to move on to the next town. And that point that Graeber makes is that coinage is a convenience that emerges when you don't have trust and you have people moving back and forth across these sort of trust lines, right? And similarly, in the United States, we talked about this before, if you're going to your local corner shop in the city in the United States in the 19th century, or you're going to your general store if you live in a frontier town, right? That guy knows you, so he's going to let you buy on tick, or he's going to write it in his ledger, and you're going to come and settle up accounts with him later, right? Because you're still around, right? He knows who you are, so he knows you're going to be able to come back and pay for it at some point. But the guy that is underwriting his business, right, he's extending credit, floating money to this guy from some Eastern investment institution, and he's extending it to the general store on the frontier. He doesn't know you as the general store proprietor, and he certainly doesn't know your customers. So he's going to offer you some sort of a loan at a pretty expensive interest rate. And this, again, points to this lack of trust issue here, which is that in the United States, they were able to sort of get by necessity a lot of times with insufficient amounts of money in circulation on a local level. As soon as you kick that up, even one notch of abstraction and alienation and estrangement, right? Now you have to somehow come up with money, right? The general store guy has to come up with physical hard cash to pay. Similarly, the government, consistently across the 19th century with the certain accepted periods that we've talked about, demanding that you pay your taxes, let alone your customs duties, but definitely your taxes in hard metal, precious bullion or coins, that they are treating you like a stranger, right? They are not extending you credit to, you know, settle up later. They're not letting you pay in kind, which was a big departure from, say, you know, European traditions where you would often be paying in grain or, you know, some alcohol or whatever, right? You can't pay in kind. You have to pay in metal. And that's because you've abstracted it to a level where there isn't trust. So this, again, points to this sort of fundamental problem here, which is that in this period in the United States, you obviously have this huge economic transformation that's happening that people are having a hard time understanding as it's happening around them, right? They're having a hard time processing, unless they're, you know, someone that's really spending a lot of time thinking about this from like a socialist industrialist perspective, or they're one of the like tippy top, you know, Rockefeller types who's probably able to see from the mountaintop what's going on to some extent, right? If you're kind of in the middle, right, ordinary middle class person, ordinary laborer, or even like the petty bourgeoisie, you're probably going to have a hard time seeing what's going on. You're going to have a hard time seeing this economic transformation happening. And all you know is, well, I need money. I need physical hard coin metal to make certain payments because I'm not always allowed to, in various contexts in my life, pay things in paper or pay things in kind or pay things later. So I need this money, but I don't have this money. What do I do about it? And this is where you know, kind of go around in circles on this. But now, today, we have this level of trust where people can say, okay, I know that if I go to this store, right, and I pay with a dollar bill, they're going to accept it. You don't have to worry about whether or not they're going to accept it. You can just pay it. And we have enough in circulation now that, for most people anyway, you don't have to have someone say, well, you can pay me back later, right? And obviously, we know there are people in society that are not paying that way, right? You know, somebody that's homeless and short on cash, right? They might find someone that is kind enough to say, it's okay, I'll give you, you know, a dinner or a sandwich or something now and for free, and, you know, maybe you can pay me back later if you can, right? And that's sort of an informal arrangement where someone is agreeing to kind of extend that trust and credit, and maybe they're just doing it sort of charitably anyway. And then, of course, on the other end of society, you know, rich people all the time are able to conduct huge transactions without necessarily moving around money on the basis of, well, you'll pay me back later. And that's sort of a whole other sphere of things. So, I mean, it sounds like you're kind of leaning in the same direction that I am here with this idea that, like, fundamentally, a lot of this is people not understanding what's happening around them, but also just a deep lack of trust and an inability to validate sort of transactions over almost any level of abstraction in the United States in this time period.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of it until you brought it up, but just the level of cons and scams and flim-flammery happening at this time. I think it's easy to forget about how common that was, but we've created a whole bunch of idioms that are surrounding this time period, like snake oil salesman, to illustrate just how how scammy the U.S. was at this time. So I think that's a good point to bring up, just why there would be this lack of trust, because there were people constantly trying to cheat people out of their belongings or their money. So there wouldn't be a lot of trust in your fellow man. And something else that I tend to forget about is just the lack of commerce happening over state lines until relatively late in our history. So this, at this point, with the railroad and telegraphy and whatnot, finally there's these inroads getting made to sell things across state lines. And so there wouldn't necessarily be a lot of trust happening at this time, just because it was so new. So I think there's a lot of things that we've talked about over past episodes that are just kind of knitted together when we're talking about money and monetary policy at this time. Just a lot of the stuff that we've talked about in the past is all kind of bring to bear on this point of money at this time. So it's really interesting to see how things are how all these concepts are intertwined. And I feel like that's been an interesting part of this show over the past year or two, really focusing deeply on this time period, is we get to see how interconnected everything is when we talk about materialist history, materialist leftist history over this time frame.
The one thing that you said reminded me of something, which I think we should also drill down into a little bit before we wrap this up. I would argue that one of the biggest cons in American history occurs over the period specifically of the late 1860s until it completely falls apart in the early 1890s, right? We've mentioned several times now on this series and previous episodes about one of the factors in that collapse in 1893 being a whole bunch of small yeoman farmers in the American West saying, I've had a bunch of bad harvests, I owe too much money on the, you know, farming equipment that I've purchased on payment plans, I am out, I'm closing up shop, I'm giving up. Let's back up a couple decades to see how we got there. Obviously, we've talked about the fact that they had to borrow a lot of money or do these financing plans basically to buy farm equipment in order to stay competitive. But the other reason that they needed to, you know, that farming became so capitally intensive in a way that it had not previously been, especially in the frontier regions, is that the farm country there was garbage. And the biggest scam in American history up to that point, arguably, was the United States government insisting that this was great land that just needed someone to start plowing and planting, and then everything would be fine, right? Now, partly there's a little bit of an effect where people are getting kind of conned accidentally, you know, even the people running this, right, this policy, because there was an unusually wet period at one point, and I think it was in the 1860s, if I remember correctly. And so, you know, there were some areas of the country that previously had been called the Great American Desert, where they said, oh, look, it's actually lush and verdant, and, you know, clearly that the climate is changing, and the, you know, the increase land-based settlement and the frontier movement is finally attracting the rain down. And this also leads into, though, the actual scammy part, which was this conviction that rain follows the plow. This is a major tenet of the Manifest Destiny doctrine. It was the idea that if you started developing an area for farming, that rain would follow if it wasn't already there. Obviously, from our perspective today, an insane belief based on nothing, but this was an official, like, propaganda line that was used to basically settle and farm the this part of the West, which in, you know, in contrast with a lot of the previous frontier areas that were now no longer frontier areas, was, again, garbage, right? Is vastly insufficient rainfall, even today, as being, you know, irrigated with very capital-intensive aquifer irrigation. And this, the U.S. government, through a series of very open scams and corruption scandals, sold large tracts of the United States to railroad companies, or basically granted it to railroad companies, and then the railroad companies would finance their own sort of laying down of rail lines by selling off, you know, every other parcel, and then the rail company would hold on to the parcels they didn't sell in between and let those appreciate as various settlements popped up, and then they would sell that off later at a higher value. And this was the idea here, right? We're going to get these railroads put in, and we're going to be settling, and then we're going to do this homesteading act, and we're going to let everyone go out there and get their little yeoman farmer plot of land and do farming, and it's great. Then the rain will come, and it will become this great, amazing farmland. And it turned out that was not true, and it required a lot of capital equipment that had not previously been the case in order to get basically any value out of it, as opposed to the southern farms that we talked about on an episode earlier that was not part of this series about the emergence of southern capitalism, where the idea was not, oh, it's so hard to get money out of this. It was, no, let's just make enormous sums of money by, you know, combining slave labor with capital equipment, right? But the situation was very bad. You couldn't get very good harvests. You were always living on a razor's edge. And that was the situation for all of these smallholder farmers in the American West. And one of the things when I said earlier about things sort of recalibrating after this period is you have a bunch of small farmers quit farming, and this really paves the way for the start of the giant agribusiness, which I think we mentioned last week on the previous episode. But that's when you start getting the groundwork for these major agribusiness corporations outside of the previous agribusiness sectors like cotton or sugar and things like that, right? And so now we have all these farmers who are getting blamed for their own situation. Like, why weren't they better, you know, fiscal household managers? They shouldn't have gotten into all that debt. And it's, they got into this debt because they were sold this giant bill of goods. And it's like, how would you trust anything at that point? How would you trust anything if the entire, like, system, society, and government has all conspired to be like, hey, there's free real estate we've just taken from the Native Americans, and it's fantastic farmland. Get out there and make your fortune. Oops. So I don't know if that had crossed your mind, but it certainly popped into my mind when you were talking there.
So yeah, it's, I mean, I live in a region that is verdant because it's next to a river, but move a few miles away from the river and it's totally arid and, totally unfarmable. And so, yeah, that's kind of interesting to think about. And like, that was part of that big, great migration wave happening at the time. You were just sending a whole bunch of people out west and saying, yeah, go farm this terrible land and prosperity will be yours. So that, yeah, it's kind of interesting. A podcast I listen to that is completely unrelated, Mark Maron, his WTF show, he talks about immigrants moving to like Minnesota and Wisconsin all the time for some reason. And just like these, just given, they were given this land basically, but it was really crappy and they were just told to farm it. And they kind of had to, scrabble together, this living.
And it gets worse and worse as you go west, right?
Yes. Like, yeah.
Iowa is worse than that. Nebraska is worse than that. And then you get to Colorado and it's like, why even bother, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Or Idaho or Wyoming or whatever. So yeah, it's kind of, I've never thought of it as a scam, but it totally is. So that's really fascinating to think about how that would definitely erode people's trust if you're just given this really crappy land and told to farm it, and then it's your fault if it fails. That would be the rug swept out from under you for sure, and a really rude awakening as to the realities of life in the frontier West.
Well, we've gone on long enough about the free silver debates and the cross of gold. Next time on the show, we'll close this series with an epilogue episode looking at what followed the 1890s and emerged out of the foundations laid in this post-Civil War period in the U.S. economy in terms of debt as money. Things like consumer finance, auto loans, home mortgages, and more. It's really important to understand sort of the cultural culmination of this sort of process of reconfiguring the economy in this period. But it's been an interesting series so far, and I think, it'll be an interesting capstone to that as well. So, Rachel, thank you for coming on this week to talk about the Cross of Gold.
Glad to be here. It's a very fascinating discussion.